From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The brutal outlines of the ongoing civil war in Syria often mask the very human stories of the people still living in a country on the verge of collapse. Families torn apart, lives stolen, futures grim. Journalist and author Alia Malik moved to Damascus in 2011, just as the country was crumbling. This hour on Point, a Syrian American's journey back to Damascus and the human stories she finds there. You can join us on air or online. Can you imagine the stories of survival and courage that come from deep suffering and lives upended by years of war? Do you know this kind of suffering? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City, Alia Malik, journalist, author, and civil rights lawyer, former senior writer at Al Jazeera America, and a former trial attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. Her new memoir is The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Alia, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
What a beautiful book. So beautifully written. At the center of it is very much your grandmother, Salma. Mm-hmm. Tell us first, to set the table for this conversation, who was she? What was she like?
Well, she was in many ways just an ordinary woman and an ordinary Syrian, which was one of the reasons so many people were suspicious of me in Syria when I told them I was writing a historical book that focused on just one Syrian woman. But she was extraordinary also in other ways. She was one of two sisters in a family of many brothers. She sort of bristled at the kinds of limitations that were placed on a woman of her generation in the country. She also was somebody. She had this deep husky voice because she was an incessant smoker. She was somebody who was very moved by the plight of other people who also felt locked out or limited by their place, their station in life in Syria. And she became somebody who people across Syria knew was somebody who could facilitate things for them in the capital if they came to Damascus. So she oftentimes was intervening on behalf of people who might not have access to power to help them resolve situations that this state wasn't necessarily paying attention to them because of who they were. And she also met a sort of tragic fate that, to me, in my mind, and it happened when I was young, when I was 6 years old, that sort of she became this kind of metaphor for what was happening to Syria at the same time in the 1980s. And it seemed like, I mean, for a long time I had wanted to write a book about her and about Syria, but ironically, there was no market for such a book until the country came apart.
So how did Salma and her family come to live in Damascus in the 1940s, and what was Damascus like then?
Well, she was a brand new bride. The country was also brand new in the sense in that it had just finally gotten its independence from France, even though Syria is one of the oldest still existing countries. Damascus, Aleppo, these are some of the cities that have been a continuous habitation for the longest time in human history. But at the same time, there was something new and something hopeful about this very ancient yet young country entering this new era. And she was at the same time a new bride. She moved to Damascus from Hama into this new building. It was sort of an expression of the kind of optimism that I think a lot of Syrians had in the late 1940s as they entered, you know, this sort of modern age. She had just married my grandfather, who was 12 years older than her and originally hailed from Homs. So even though they were both from outside of Damascus, their lives came to be very much in Damascus, as were the lives of my parents.
Your grandmother's neighborhood in Damascus, where the book takes place, was closely knit, an intimate place. And your introduction to the street is charming, and I wish you'd read that for us now.
Ah, yes. One second. So this neighborhood is called Ayn al-Kirish, which, and I go into the sort of etymology of the name, but when I was growing up, I always thought Ayn al-Kirish meant the eye of the belly and therefore belly button. This is not a correct translation, but that always felt correct because, like, my connection to Syria was somehow umbilical. So this is the description of the neighborhood it starts, the neighborhood was both residential and commercial. There were two bakeries, which meant that the air in the early morning smelled like fresh bread, while in the afternoon, when the date-filled pastries were made, it became sweeter. With no stoves in people's houses until the 1970s, dishes that needed to be baked, kibbeh, for example, ground lamb with bulgur and seasonings, were sent raw to the bakeries to finish them. Selma, my grandmother, had a kerosene heater for items that could be prepared on a stovetop, which is how many Syrian delicacies are cooked. Along the streets were a few fruit and vegetable vendors, a butcher, a stationery shop, a pharmacy, and a roaster of all kinds of nuts, both sweet and savory. A person could find just about everything one might need nearby, and what wasn't in a brick-and-mortar shop, the street vendors would be selling. With a donkey pulling a cart carrying the goods, they'd announce their presence by shouting out whatever they were hawking. Cucumbers, like baby fingers, the perfect size for pickling. Watermelon, we'll slice it open to show you just how red. The worst vendor was easily the overzealous kerosene seller who used an obnoxious horn to announce his arrival on the street. With a barrel strapped across his donkey's back, he'd guide it slowly down the street until a maid or family member could run out with the family's aluminum canister to fill it up.
Talk to me about the building where your grandmother lived, called the Tahan. You describe in the book the people who lived in that building, the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, the Armenians, the Kurds, all these people with such different backgrounds, culturally, religiously, working together, loving together, and suffering together in very close quarters. It was quite beautiful, actually. Describe it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good literary device. Well, you know, until the sort of modern era in Syria, people lived in single family houses more, where would have the large. If you were to think of, like, say, a Spanish hacienda, you know, had the fountain in the center and the rooms around it. But by the 1920s and 30s and 40s, multifamily buildings were beginning to be built. And I said that, and the way that it worked on this street, which I then came to live in myself, was that each building in and of itself was a kind of honeycomb, but together the entire street was like a beehive. And there was a flurry of activity, and it was impossible not to, I think especially after having lived as families in these single family homes, that it would have been impossible to not let that sort of carry over into this new style of living. And it was actually my great aunt who lives in Cape Cod who told me that when she moved to Damascus in the 60s, she said one of the best indicators of how well everybody got along in the building was the cleanliness of the stairs. Mm. And that really is quite true, because it took, you know, kind of collective action for everybody to push that dust off, because, you know, dust accumulates quickly in a dry place like Syria. And my grandmother was the ringleader of sorts in her building. She was the last person in our building who was able to corral everybody to participate. Mm.
You went back to Damascus to actually reclaim and renovate your grandmother Selma's apartment. Tell me about that decision to return to Damascus and how your family reacted to that.
Well, I mean, I think to some people it could seem insane that right at the beginning of the Arab Spring you put all your stuff in storage in New York City and moved to Damascus. But to me it made perfect sense. I knew that whatever was coming to Syria was going to change it. And I wanted an opportunity to live in Syria as opposed to just being a tourist who's passing in and out of Syria in this last phase, and to also be there to greet it as it went into what I was hopeful was going to be a new optimistic and progressive phase. My parents had lost the house, or her mother, Selma, and then my mother had lost the house in 1970, the same year Hafez al-Assad came to power. And it was, by law, we were unable to get it back until the law changed in 2004, and then that set us up for a big court battle with the tenant who had never left. And we had just gotten it back in 2010 and had just begun to start the renovation, ironically, at a time when the country was about to fall apart. And it provided me with a cover story. You know, I could be in Syria. You know, people in Syria, both the secret police and relatives, are always, and neighbors, are always asking you all kinds of what we would consider invasive questions. And I needed sort of a way to justify why I would be there at that time that didn't validate people's suspicions that I might be some kind of, you know, CIA operative. Also, the fact that I work in human rights and then became a journalist. journalists. I mean, these are, you know, hazards to your health in Syria as occupations. Mm-hmm. So the renovation was something that people could. I mean, it was true. I was finishing the renovation. My parents had begun the renovation. We had been struggling for 40 years to get the house back. And of course, you know, as a writer, there's a metaphor there mm-hmm. that I couldn't ignore.
Well, so talk about that. The Damascus that you left in 2013, you were there for 2 years. How did that compare mm-hmm. to the Damascus that you had studied and heard about all the family memories and the stories from your research during that time? Compare those two places.
And for my time there. Well, you know, one of the bargains, you know, so for your listeners who might not know, Syria has been in sort of a kind of totalitarian control for the last 40 plus years. And one of the bargains that you, I think, people make is that means a certain kind of stability. And the rules of engagement are quite clear before 2011. You know, dissent would not be welcomed. It will be punished. It will be punished severely. And the consequences would be borne not just by you, but by your family and those around you. But there was security and safety and stability. You could walk the streets of Damascus at any hour and nobody would even dare to rob you or to harass you in any way in that sense. And of course that requires a lot of fear, a fear of the state, an internalized fear of the informants. In 2011, the fear was still there, but the other side of the bargain wasn't there. It became chaotic and there wasn't safety and stability and security. People were able to get away with petty crimes much more. People were able to kidnap and ransom people that they thought might be rich. And the state looked away at that as sort of a way to, I think, really punish people for, as a way to sort of say, well, okay, you want to rise up against us? This is what will happen in exchange. And I arrived in Syria to a lot of anxiety and trepidation. People did not know what was going to come next. And they knew that the state would probably engage in high levels of violence to maintain its power.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashberg, we're talking about the ongoing civil war in Syria this hour and the extraordinary stories of ordinary civilians living in a conflict zone. You can join the conversation. Do you find yourself slowly slipping away from following the depressing, unending headlines? What keeps you engaged, keeps you caring? Here's a clip, Isabel Young, a reporter with HBO's Vice News Tonight, describing the constant government propaganda in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Regime loyal and salaried men drive pickup trucks festooned with flags and portraits of Bashar al-Assad through the streets.
In government-controlled Damascus, residents are inundated with pro-regime propaganda, glorifying the image of Syria's longtime dictator. Day and night, people are bombarded with this message.
We're talking with journalist and author Alia Malik, whose memoir, The Country That Was Our Home, a memoir of Syria, is just out. Alia, in your memoir, you describe living under a dictatorship and learning to speak the coded language of oppression, as you call it. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Well, the interesting thing about the propaganda that goes along with the Assad regime, both, you know, father and son, is that I think unlike other places, like unlike how we perceive North Korea, no, very few people in Syria actually buy into it. For 40 years, people have sort of gone along with it, and everyone knows sort of that it's this very vulgar, manufactured kind of cult. And I was trying to understand when I was there, you know, why people would go along. What was the messaging that was happening? And, you know, to give you an example, there was early on a 13-year-old who was detained by the regime and then killed by the regime. And when his body was released to the family, it had signs of incredible torture. And, you know, state TV then aired this, I think videos of the body were not supposed to get out. And then so the state responded through state TV with this expose about how all these injuries were actually caused by the demonstrators post-mortem. And, I mean, it was clearly ridiculous. It was clearly a charade. But so I was trying to understand why Why bother with the charade? And then as the camera lingered on the damage that had been done to this boy's body, I came to understand that, you know, it was a way to hide a threat in plain sight. And that was what I came to understand was sort of like as that coded language, that what we were, even though they were, this whole charade was about denying that they had done the damage to this child, it was actually showing us the damage that they could do to our children or to anybody. And so don't get any ideas about thinking you're going to displace us from power. And I think, you know, I began to constantly have a sort of decoder filter in my head at the sorts of ridiculous propaganda that had a different meaning behind it. And it was quite menacing, in fact.
You write that the Assad government works hard to create the impression of a serene and livable Damascus at the same time, right, with a population that is both, quote, deceived and used. You write, like me, some of my family were troubled by how power had been passed on like an inheritance. But they responded to my prodding with raised eyebrows, a roll of their eyes or a sheepish smile. The walls still have ears, after all, you write. What was it like for your family? Because many of them are still there, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's it like for them now?
Well, it depends where you are. You know, in Damascus, where the regime or the state does carry out this, you know, is trying to maintain this appearance of normalcy, it doesn't, you know, there isn't as much mortar fire as there was before, and there isn't, you know, the state air force or the Russian air force flying above dropping barrel bombs, but there's no, like, there's maybe an hour of electricity a day. There isn't much water. Everything, inflation has caused the price of everything to go up. So it's cold. It's, you know, they're, you know, not hungry, but it's not the same as it was before. But then that situation is relatively so much better than, say, a place like Aleppo, which has been under constant bombardment. So it does depend on where you are. And then, you know, life is very much normal in the coastal regions where the state has many supporters, or and also is like the homeland of the Assad family, where they hail from. So it depends on where you are, but it's very difficult, especially for my family that had sort of reached the age of retirement. This was supposed to be the years where, okay, you'd sort of foregone civil rights and civil liberties, but these were the years where you were going to be able to afford everything, be able to go to your children's weddings, be able to enjoy your grandchildren. And now that is obviously very much in question. And it was harder, and that's why a lot of my family that's of that generation has stayed behind. My younger cousins have made their way to Europe or to other places, nobody via the sea. But, you know, this is something that each person has to decide for themselves.
During your time in Damascus, you become friends with a young peace activist who you call Carnations.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to read that from the book. She was arrested, and you meet up with her.
Afterwards, right. Right. And she was arrested after having spoken to me for an article. But not really. I did not know this at the time, but I had interviewed her for an article that ended up running without a byline on the front page of the New York Times. So I was panicked that maybe somehow I had caused her to be arrested and that then they were coming for me afterwards. But in fact, she was taken for something else, and you'll understand why I gave her this code name. So after she'd been released, I saw her. So when I saw Carnations, I hugged her tight. And then over frothy, iced coffees, we talked about her arrest, her cell, and her interrogation. As she told it, the flowers operation had been a few days in the making. Four young women were to carry bunches of carnations and hand them out to passersby on the street. They wanted to counter the regime's image of the activists as terrorists or foreign paid agents, and they wanted to register some resistance to the regime's demand that Damascenes act as if nothing were happening in the rest of the country. On that afternoon, the young women had set out in pairs. Her partner had finished handing out the last of her flowers, and Carnations still had three left and was about to cross a street when an Opel station wagon, they didn't need to be marked, everyone knew these belonged to the Mukhabara at the Syrian secret police, pulled up next to her. Two men with large guns across their bodies jumped in her way. "We got her," yelled one of them. "Go find the other." But the other woman, without flowers in her hand, wasn't so easy to spot. She had kept going, even though she saw Carnations get stopped. They had agreed beforehand that if one got detained, the other should just walk away. The man sent to find her returned alone. "What's in your hand?" asked the man, blocking Carnations' way. She nervously laughed and answered, "Flowers." He snatched them from her and read the tag. Stop the killing? Who are you saying that to? Before she could answer, he told her to get in the car. And that set off a six-day detention, which is, you know, relatively quite good of a situation to be in.
So you're in Syria in the midst of all this. You had gone there to renovate your grandmother's apartment. At what point during your time there did it become clear to you that you and your family, you know, wouldn't be returning to this place? You wouldn't be able to stay. And how difficult was that for you?
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I was even hopeful 2 years ago when I left that I would be somehow able to return. You know, I guess it's a question of whether the publication of this book means that I can't return at the moment. I mean, it's painful, but at the same time, it's also really angering, you know, because people say to me, you know, Syrians specifically, they're like, well, you know, if you wanted to return, then you should have known, you shouldn't have written that book or, you know, been a journalist or been a human rights lawyer. And that's what's so infantilizing, that, you know, I've actually done nothing wrong. And yet that I might be precluded from returning is obviously frustrating and painful. And I think that's why many courageous Syrians decide not to leave if they can manage to stay. Because why abdicate the country to those who would destroy it just to maintain some power? I mean, that is one of the questions that's something that's going to separate the Syrians who fled in some ways from the Syrians who stayed behind. It's already a kind of, you know, a badge of honor to have remained. But then, of course, people outside would say, well, you had to make a deal with the devil to remain. I mean, I don't know. So this is something that's going to the Syrians are going to have to navigate amongst themselves, as much as it's something personal to me as well.
Your book begins with the line, by the time I left Syria in May 2013, many in my family were happy to see me go. Talk about that. Some of your family members actually in Syria thought you were a spy. Others were afraid that you'd put them in danger. Must have been very painful.
Yeah, I mean, that's the balancing act, because I think I mentioned earlier, one of the ways the regime is very effective at cutting down on dissent is, okay, you might be willing to face arrest and torture for yourself, but are you really willing to commit those in your family to the same fate? And that is what happens, right? I mean, if it's you, if you're vocal, if you're visible, then they can take that out on your family. And so even though I was working, you know, anonymously whenever I did journalism in there, that at some point, like, it might have caught up with me, and I didn't want anybody else to bear the consequences for what I was doing. Also, it was becoming dangerous, and no matter what, I blend in and stand out at the same time. And in a time when people were kidnapping people that they perceived to be rich, and of course a foreigner would, to some extent, or somebody with an American passport would be perceived to be rich, you know, that was a risk that even if I wanted to take that on to myself, I couldn't do that to the people that cared about me. And, you know, there were other reasons, personal reasons also, to come back to the U.S. at the time that I came back.
Let's go to Melissa here in Barrie, Vermont. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air with Alia Malik.
Hi,
welcome.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you so much for being on air and sharing your experiences. I myself actually visited Syria in my early 20s as a study abroad student, and remember with warm fondness the hospitality that families and individuals gave us when I was in Damascus, welcoming us in over the Easter weekend, with the high holy days and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And to think of what's happening today brings me great sadness, but just hearing your stories and your experiences has brought back those memories, and I look forward to picking up your book and reading more about it.
Melissa, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for sharing that. And please share your memories and your experiences in Syria with as many people around you, because it's unfortunate that Syrians have been completely sort of erased or made invisible by our constant focus on forces like ISIS or just focusing on the military or the political aspect of the story. Thank you, Melissa. I'm glad you had a wonderful time in Syria.
Alia Malik, your research wraps together so many different anecdotal and actual histories for this book. Talk about that process. You became quite a genealogist in the midst of this, I presume.
Yeah, and a bit of a medium too, to commune with the dead. It was not easy because, you know, there were, and one of the reasons I finally reluctantly chose to use different generations of my family to tell this story is because there were a ton of colorful characters, and they had intersected with moments of Syrian history as a writer, or someone who's trying to construct a large narrative at pretty much the right times. But a lot of I think as in any family, the stories that are told and passed down become, you know, adulterated or aggrandized or hidden, or the real significance sort of lost. And I read a lot of the wonderful scholarly and academic work that has been done, specifically of the era of the end of the Ottoman Empire era in Syria. And there were so many scholars who not only, I would read their work email them follow-up questions, but who also got on the phone with me and helped me make sense, you know, to understand why people's motivations might have been X, Y, or Z at the time.
So give us an example. Yeah. Tell us about one of those colorful characters.
Well, so my great-grandfather had participated, had been an active funder of a lot of the uprisings against the French when the French tried and then successfully moved into Syria at the end of the Ottoman Empire. And when I looked at who he was, so I had also heard that, he really hated the Turks. And this has sort of become part of the Arab nationalist narrative that, you know, at the end of the Ottoman Empire, it's the Lawrence of Arabia story that people all across the Arab-speaking world naturally coalesced around Arab nationalism and were happy to see the Ottoman Empire end. And when you start to dig at that, and I looked at the people who he was giving money to, like Ibrahim Hanano, you know, the historians have sort of gone much deeper in the last 20 years at this history. You could, read Keith Watton Powell's book on this. And Hanano, for example, was a man from Aleppo who had studied in Constantinople at the time. He was very much whatever Ataturk was, you know, creating out of the fallen empire, he wanted to be a part of. So how do I reconcile that my great-grandfather is heavily funding Ibrahim Hanano with this family story that he supposedly really hated the Turks? And so when you start to piece it together, you see that what had become like the greater Syrian and Arab nationalist narrative had kind of been, had reinterpreted his actions at the time. And so I had to kind of excavate what was really going on at the time, what people at the time were thinking, how they would have seen themselves at the time. And I'm grateful to the historians who were always so accessible and available and willing to talk about minutiae. I guess that's what they're for, but they're amazing.
So what did you learn about yourself by going back to Damascus and talking to the people in this apartment building, in this neighborhood where your grandparents lived? What did you learn about yourself by going to Damascus and really discovering your family?
Wow, that's a tough question, Jane. What did I learn about myself? I learned that I kind of already always knew this, but I really understand it now, what it is to come from, you know, from generations. When you're in diaspora, when you're the only branch, the only sprig, only leaf of your family over here, you don't understand that there is generational trauma, that there's sort of like a generational pathology. There are things, the behaviors that I came to understand so much more clearly when I saw them being enacted in other branches and other sprigs of my family in Syria. I had never had that fully immersed exposure to being part of something, even in a family sense, much, much larger. And I also, you know, I think a lot of people have questions, especially when you're hyphenated American, as to where you belong. I mean, I had resolved those for myself a while ago, but I felt very much a New Yorker after it all. I feel very much that the story and the life that I've lived and the friends and the community that I have are very much something that would only be possible here.
We're discussing Syria, the civil war, and family history this hour, and you can join the conversation. Does your family have its own story of survival? How are you preserving those stories for the next generation? We go out here with A Sad Morning Every Morning by Syrian clarinetist Kenan Osma. It's the first piece he wrote after more than a year of silence following the beginning of the Syrian civil war. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYpod. And thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm speaking this hour with Alia Malik, journalist and author, about her beautiful new memoir of family and conflict, The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. And you can join the conversation. How far would you go to fight for your freedom? How far have you gone? I just want to play this sound here. This is the day after ISIS was forced out of the Syrian city of Al-Bab in mid-February. ISIS sent in 2 suicide car bombers in revenge attacks, killing more than 60 Syrians. Here, Al Jazeera reporter Andrew Simmons reports on one of the attacks at a Free Syrian Army checkpoint.
The vast majority of victims are civilians who were preparing to leave this village and go back to their homes in the city, waiting in their family cars or on motorbikes for clearance at an FSA checkpoint. A vehicle pulled up and exploded. It was a suicide attack. No warning, no chance of escape.
Alia Malik, in December 2011, you write about the first large-scale bombing attack to hit the city of Damascus. It was just before the Christmas holiday. Mm-hmm. And I wish you'd read that from your book.
Sure. Okay. But just before the holiday, on December 23rd, the first big explosion rocked Damascus. 2 suicide car bombs exploded outside of Syrian military intelligence agency buildings, killing 44 people and injuring 166. The regime quickly blamed al-Qaeda and took Arab League observers already in Syria to the site. I felt certain the government itself was responsible for the strike, that it wanted to rattle Damascenes and perhaps specifically Christians. Dutifully, priests were paraded on TV to state their support for calm and the regime. A group of Christian women I had gotten to know had met with the clergy and tried to convince them at least to stay silent if they couldn't speak out on behalf of the protesters. The women believed that failing to speak out was immoral and callous to the suffering of other Syrians. In the long run, they argued, the regime would someday fall, and those Syrians who had come to power that day might very well hold the actions of the priests against all Christians. The priests asked the women, "Do you think we have much choice?" implying that to protect Christian communities, they had to play along with the regime. Whoever carried out the bombing, it was a frightening development. Either agents of chaos were now in Syria and would operate by their own opaque rules of engagement, or the government had cynically targeted itself to give credence to its narrative and to dissuade Damascenes from rising up. Both of these explanations meant we were on a slippery slope. A Pandora's box was opening that couldn't be emptied.
With so much bloodshed and so much death, how do people in Syria, the people that you interviewed, does it become commonplace? I mean, how do you process it? How do you get through each day?
Well, I think there are people who are severely traumatized. I read some report by... came out, I think, 2 weeks ago, that somebody was suggesting that they needed to create a new word for the level of trauma that some Syrian children have been subjected to. You know, people react to it very, very differently. There are people who are able to lead a life and somehow block out what is happening in other parts of the country. You know, I talk about what I found when I got there a few years ago, and I do think there are people who are beholden to some kind of exaggerated Stockholm syndrome, that if you were to, because there is a level of And this is gonna, I don't mean this as harsh as it's going to sound, but there is a level of complicity, right? You can be both the victim of a totalitarian regime and a bystander to some extent. And even if that was the most pragmatic choice and the only choice, and I think that's why there is among some sectors a willingness to sort of believe the unbelievable, to kind of be able to justify looking away or to justify not doing anything about what's happening. And then there are other people. I mean, listen, there are lives that have been completely destroyed for generations. There are futures that have been stolen. I'm not a professional in the mental health space, but let's just say it's catastrophic.
Let's get some more callers in here. Sure. Carolyn is in Oak Grove, Kentucky. Hi, Carolyn. I'm glad you called.
Hi.
Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
I feel kind of a disconnected sisterhood. I don't know if that makes any sense. During World War II, my mom's biological parents were basically forced out of France because they were gypsies. And then my mother was adopted, and when my mother's parents, her adoptive parents, died, the gypsy excommunicated us. So basically, I have no family, and that's how I felt a connection, is that I have no one but my mother. Mm. And that's where my connection came in.
Mm. Carolyn, thank you. A disconnected sisterhood, Carolyn says. Mm. It's an interesting phrase.
Yeah.
Dan is in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Yeah. And thank you, Aaliyah. Really just powerful stuff.
Thanks,
and I think
Dan.
It's very brave to be a dissenter, especially coming from Syria. I work with refugees here in Cleveland, Ohio. I take people for their doctor's appointments and whatnot. I'm a volunteer. And I've just heard a lot of callers talk about, you know, oh, immigrants come here and they're not assimilating. And I just want to maybe draw some parallels when we just look at history. I mean, I think it's kind of the most American story is, you know, new people come here and, you know, if you're not the first one here, you're kind of, you know, have this prejudice against the new arrivals. But I just think about the story of Cleveland. You know, you have German Catholics, Irish Catholics come here and, you know, they're looked down on for their religion. And now, you know, we have neighborhoods here. You know, I work with Iraqis, Assyrians, with people from Congo, and they come here, and their children, you know, have futures now. They're in school, and that is just such a huge thing for these parents. And I think their futures are bright here, and I think they're an instrumental part of our city and of the fabric of our city and the story, and it's a shame that it's so American that there has to be this prejudicial attitude towards the newest comers. But I just look back at history, and I guess that's the story of America. Mm. And just, you know, I just wish well for everybody. And I think,
Okay, quickly,
more?
Yes.
Yeah, quickly. I just look at it, and it just really baffles me when Donald Trump went up there at his inauguration address and just said, you know, God is on our side. And I just remember the God he's talking about was a first century Palestinian minority Jew. And, you know, let's just think about that for all the Christians here. Islam
all right,
is
Dan,
our enemy.
Thank you very much. Let me ask you about what's going on right now, Aaliyah. This revised travel ban that's just been released. I'm curious, given your history, given this book, what you and your family and your friends have experienced in Syria, what's your reaction to the president's actions to what's going on now?
Well, I mean, my reaction, first and foremost, is as an American, and it's pretty un-American. And I think, luckily, we have an amazing set of checks and balances, and I think the courts will continue to probably defeat these kinds of measures. You know, but all of this, everything that's been happening with Syria in the past few years is just, I mean, if you want a personal answer, is a reminder of how random and arbitrary fate is. You know, I've been thinking a lot about how your fate in your potential in this world as a Syrian today, it very much depends on what comes after the word Syrian. Is it immigrant? Is it refugee? Is it American, which is my case? And it's obviously a massive stroke of fortune, even though it was chance. You know, my parents ended up with an unintended life here in the United States. I just, about today's current environment, I mean, what is And yes, it's true, as Dan said, there is something very American about, you know, putting everybody down before we accept them as Americans and as, you know, important parts of our society. But, you know, when the tone is being set from the top, that just it's just embarrassing as an American, and it's ahistorical. And, you know, I'm very grateful for people like Dan and their service and their willingness to decide for themselves what this country should be about and who these people are.
Dan, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Robert in Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. Glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I want to say to your guests that, you know, in listening to your speech and your story and your comportment, you, by your presence alone, you have dispelled, I think, a lot of the fear, like this ridiculous notion being put forth by our current president that Syrian people are somehow terrorists and they deserve to be banned from coming into this country. This absolutely ridiculous notion. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and in my neighborhood, and there was a big Syrian population. I'm not of Syrian descent, but I knew many of both immigrants, first and second generation people of Syrian descent, and I can say without a doubt, they are upright, hardworking people, want the same things as all the rest of us, to raise their children in peace and to educate them, and they are good Americans.
Robert, thank you. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Robert.
Alia, I just wanted to ask you, your book begins in 2011. We talked about the early days of the Arab Spring, the uprising. The book ends as you encounter neighbors who have ended up as refugees in Europe. Tell me about that. What was that like?
Well, I don't want to give away the ending. So it's a specific neighbor, and so it has this very emotional and personal component. But I mean, it is painful. I did the so-called refugee trail. I traveled with Syrians and Iraqis and Afghans and everybody else from Greece to Germany in September of 2015. I've been back 6 months since and 12 months since. I mean, to me, it's this strange, again, it's about the vagaries of fate. You know, I went on the refugee trail because in great part I had an idea where a lot of these people were coming from. I was in the middle of writing this book on Syria, and I also had an idea of where they were headed, you know, as they were going to become part of what hopefully will be successful multicultural societies. I'm an example of that. I also wrote, my first book is A Country Called America. It's a retelling of American history as it's been lived by Arabs in the United States. And, you know, I also left Syria with my mom when she was pregnant with me, and I couldn't help but thinking over and over how different everything was and how it's just so arbitrary to be, you know, the luck is arbitrary. But the other thing I kept thinking about, especially in this meeting, was that at the same time that Europe will be in many ways enriched by the efforts of Syrians and those who will come to live there and work there and generate, you know, taxes there and serve those societies, it's such a drain for Syria. You know, a lot of Syria's, you know, this is Syria's working middle class. A lot of it has just disappeared. And that's in many ways an outcome that the regime would like. It doesn't want the challenge of those who would exercise the agency of rejecting both its bombardment, its control, and then the whatever vision, nihilist vision people like ISIS have for the region. I mean, that's the thing. You know, we talk about them as a scourge and as whatever, as leeches. But what these are people basically who have exercised the choice to reject either of those futures for themselves and their families, that the people who would rule Syria would have them live.
Let's get one more call in here. Julie in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Julie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to share my family story. I was born in the U.S., but my parents were once refugees from Palestine. They immigrated to this country about 50 or so years ago. And, you know, my father came with nothing, put himself through school, and eventually worked for NASA, helped send space shuttles, you know, to the moon. And I think those kinds of stories are what have been conveniently forgotten. You know, my parents now, you know, they take my calls as we help refugees here in Charlotte. As we, you know, just the other day, we had a refugee from Syria. We took to the doctor, and we had some trouble translating. Unfortunately, I don't speak Arabic, but called my mom on the phone. She translated for him, got him the, you know, the help that he needed. And, you know, they felt so proud and thankful to do that. And I just, you know, I just wish that more people would recognize those types of contributions that immigrants, you know, Muslims, refugees make every day in this country.
Julie, thank you. Thanks very much.
That's true. That's why I wrote my first book. I just was sort of, you know, the invisibility. I mean, people from the Arabic-speaking world have been coming to the U.S. since the late 1800s, which is exactly when other people that we easily imagine as American, Greek-Americans, Italian-Americans have been coming to this country. And, you know, it's the... It's sort of like a double-edged sword. We've been both invisible in American historical narratives and American consciousness. At the same time, we've been hyper-visible only as foreign and as, you know, this menace from overseas. So, yeah, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to you know, bring these stories to light. They're part of us.
Julie, thanks so much for the call, Julie. There in Charlotte. Aliyah, just a couple minutes left here. You were hopeful at the beginning of this journey that change would come to Syria. Do you still have hope now?
Well, look, I mean, the arc of history is long, and you have to keep that in the back of our minds. And there are some positives in some ways that are coming out of this. I think a lot of the barriers that used to exist between Syrian people in many ways have come down, in part because outside of Syria, you can't control these spaces of dialogue. And I think... I think, you know, Syrians that I've seen already in diaspora have been working so hard to try to maintain the fabric of the society, which that is what those of us who actually care about Syria care about the most, like the fraying of the society. And people are working hard to stem that. But I think it's going to be a very long and difficult road and a lot of damage. I mean, what has happened to Syria is catastrophic. And it shouldn't just be people who, you know, have been to Syria or know about Syria who understand that. That's sort of a failure of our, you know, our education and our media, not specifically journalists, but like, and how little we know of these places that we make very quick political decisions about, and what little we know of our own American history in the region.
Last 20 seconds, Aliyah, what would your grandmother think of this journey?
Oh, I'd like to think that she'd be proud and that she'd be happy I wasn't a smoker.
Aliyah Malik, author of The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane. This was delightful. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.